This episode of Bend the Knee is brought to you by our bannermen, Lord Jason of House Ross, Sir Jimmy of House Nuts, Master of the Web, Lady Dawn of House Wright, Sir Chris of House Farber, Lady Tracy of House Faw, Sir Peter of House Whittingham, Sandy the Dragon, Blood of Queen Daenerys and Lady of Jameson, Lord Brett of House Fry, Lady Juliana of House Stradley, Sir David of House Fraser, Lady Liz of House Hendricks, Sir Matthew of House Perry, Lady Madeline of House Fritzel.
This episode of Bend the Knee is protected by Lady Amanda of House Richardson, Sir Ryan of House Terbush, Lord Robert the Unfrozen of House Butler, Lord Paramount of Skagos Island, Lady Sarah the Unraveler.
Our current champion is Lady Kira of House Arnold.
Our current Master of Coin is Lord Jason of House Ross. Welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt the Bud Knight, Fist of the Dragon, Maker of Gains, and Co-Lord of the White Claw.
And I am Sir Ezra the Watchful, Stealer of Hearts, Bandit of Time, Hero of Shreve, Picker of Bones, and Co-Lord of the White Claw. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into Catelyn 6 of A Clash of Kings, and in our Maester's Study we will be discussing Alicent Hightower.
Yeah, as we're going to continue diving through and getting ready for House of the Dragon, right? We've been getting slow little bits of news here, and we're going to keep that kind of series going. And I think we're starting off with a raven today.
We are starting off with a raven, and I also want to start off with a disclaimer that Sunday is the day we record, and it's also laundry day. So if you can hear my washer in the background, that goes... As is that, I said, I think the entire complex can hear it right now. It's in spin cycle.
As literally your video is just...
is shaking, is it not? It's shaking, I know. And it's like, I feel like it represents kind of the start to 2021 for us, okay? In spin cycle. We're all in spin mode right now, and it's just crazy, man. It is absolutely wild, so...
Yeah.
Anyways, I do want to start off with the Raven, though, because I think this is kind of fun. Just really, some of these are people who send us a raven, and it's less a theory. It's more just about the podcast, where they're at, finding the show, that kind of stuff. As the new year comes in, we get new listeners. We get old listeners coming back and things like that. It's really neat. So greetings and happy new year, Sir Matt and Sir Ezra. I've been a Song of Ice and Fire fan since the beginning. And by the way, this is from Steph, the Mostly Silent Sister. So thank you. Thank you, Steph. Mm-hmm. I've been a Song of Ice and Fire fan since the beginning, reading the books as they came out in the 90s, rereading them when the show started and Dance of Dragons came out. Last winter, I wanted to do another reread and was looking around for a read-along podcast and found yours. Then COVID hit, and after months of working from home and taking long walks, I caught up on the latest chapter and podcast yesterday. Wow, so we got this just like a week or two ago, I think. Love all of your insights and rabbit holes. Clash is the book I've read the least, so really enjoying it this time. And also looking ahead to my favorite, Storm of Swords. Also really appreciate all of your discussion on Fire and Blood, which I had a really hard time reading. Now I'm going to need something else to binge. Guessing I'm going to have to give Wheel of Time another try. Steph, the Mostly Silent Sister. I think you should. I think you should. Wheel of Time will occupy you for quite some time, my friends. So that's the other podcast that Matt and I have been working on. That podcast is just over a year old, and it's called Heroes of the Horn, a Wheel of Time podcast. So yeah, that'd be great. And Steph, here's the thing. Clash of Kings, not necessarily my favorite book. So it's been this... Yeah, I know. People might not like that. Storm of Swords is amazing, and then I love...
It's the best.
It is probably the best. And Dance of Dragons is great, too. Really enjoy that book. So, yeah, anyways, it is what it is. So we're trudging through here, and we're making good progress, though. I think we're going to be done with this book in a couple months, or towards the summer, mm-hmm. I think we said. So yeah, we'll be getting there. We'll be getting there soon for sure. So, but yeah, thank you again. Really appreciate that. And then let's jump into another one here. This is Sir Silas sending us a raven as well. Good evening, my lords. Happy New Year. I have not written to you both since sending my origin story back in August of 2019. I can't begin to explain how much I've enjoyed and appreciated your podcast, although I do not write in. I have listened to all of your episodes, and I even listened to Hyperspace Hangout, as Star Wars is my favorite series. There we go. Another listener to another project, Hyperspace Hangout. If interested, I could send a follow-up email with some of my Lego Star Wars collection, which absolutely, please, please, you know, I've had that since I was 8. Gosh, I could go for a good Lego set, actually.
You know, why isn't there Lego Game of Thrones yet?
Right? Yeah, I mean, what's going on?
Or is it just too, is the source material just too dark? I would buy Lego, I would buy Lego Game of Thrones. They'd be pretty cool, with some dragons and castles. I mean, I'm sure there are people that have like made their own, because there's tons of Lego castle, you know, medieval stuff you could do.
Right, yeah, that's interesting. Is the source material too dark? we need an adult Lego set.
Then you could you know, I mean, even, you know, you make it a little bit, a little more kid friendly by making it like there's Lego Lord of the Rings. I mean, not that there's, you know, hooking up in Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or. I'll have to look and see what all content has been given the Lego treatment to see what's like the darkest.
How far can we push it? Oh, gosh. Yeah. All right. Well, when I first went looking for a podcast to scratch my Game of Thrones itch until the final season premiered, I did not expect to find something that became extremely important to me. Listening to your podcast, both the Bend the Knee and Hyperspace Hangout, has helped me go through a tough breakup with a long-term girlfriend of 4 years, and it's helped me get through the stress of 2020 that many people have been facing. And yeah, no kidding. I mean, I think even for Matt and I, we would say like having the podcast and having the podcasting projects has been fun for us, and it's kept us kind of going. I hope it has given some people some joy and happiness and some fun escape, you know, from all the craziness that has gone on in 2020, and that's kind of continuing here in 2021. So although I think the future is bright, and I even started a new book series, The Wheel of Time, mainly because I wanted to follow another one of your podcasts, because I enjoy hanging out with you and listening to all of the Raven/transmissions. Love the books, by the way. Just wanted to say thank you. Looking back at this year, listening to the both of you has been one of my favorite things and something I look forward to each week. May the gods heal your wounds, Sir Silas. And I just want to say thank you to, we've gotten a couple of those, and I really, it always kind of blows me away, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to send that in, and to write that, and send that to us, because, you know, we, I don't know, man, we sometimes, Matt and I, we do run several projects, we have goals, we have ambitions, you know, this podcast is called Bend the Knee for a reason, okay? Like, we love hanging out, talking to each other, talking about these series, and making content, and so it's really nice that you guys are enjoying it, and we always try to make it better, we always try to reflect and you know, up our game, and it's sort of a evolution, man. It just kind of keeps, I don't know, we keep evolving and getting better and better, and it's just, it's so much fun, and I really appreciate folks sending that in.
Okay, I will say, I did some searches here on Amazon. There are certainly 3D puzzles of like Winterfell and stuff like that. There are some things here, you know, what is it? Mega Constructs? I think, you know, remember Mega Blocks back in the day? They were like the opposite of Lego, but I think, I don't know, it looks like that. So I mean, it is kind of like Lego-y, but it's not Lego.
So they went dark. Did Mega Blocks go dark?
They went dark. Okay.
Merry Christmas.
So there is some version of that might that might work. So that's definitely pretty cool. And I think you can go on Etsy and find people who've like custom painted Legos and stuff like that. So that's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Okay. So do you have any news?
Well, one more thing, because some news going on here in Ohio. I just want to say, as this episode rolls out, we are recording this before. You know, Matt's he's wearing his shirt today. He's representing the Pittsburgh Steelers over there. You know, a lot of our listeners are into the old American sports. And I just want to say that I am rooting for the Browns. I know.
Wow.
I know he's going to be upset about that, but it's simply because I have to. I just have to.
You do realize that Pittsburgh is closer to you than Cleveland, right?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. I posted on my Instagram story the other day, by the way, at @WompBrett_2M. You guys can follow me there. Follow Matt at @SuperGainsBros. So I was like, I posted this. Matt sent me this graphic, and Sir Jimmy wrote back to me instantly when I posted that graphic that you sent me as well. Where I was like, it basically was like, what was it? The champions, right? It was the past, and
whatever Instagram account that was has done it for all of the divisions in football. Yeah. And I was just like, wow, you know, that's kind of interesting. Like a lot of these other divisions, it's like, you know, there's four teams and it's the past 15 years. And I'm like, you know, some of these other ones like, oh, okay, here's all these. There was a couple other ones that did not have all four teams represented, most notably the NFC North. So sorry for you Detroit Lions fans out there.
Oh, wow.
Like you've won it. But in this one, it's like, well, I see the Browns. I see the Ravens. Or excuse me. Right. I see the Bengals. I see the Steelers. Right. I see the Ravens. But I don't see the Browns in there.
Didn't see them in there, did you? Yeah, I know.
I think you have to go back to like, actually, they've technically, I don't think, ever even won the NFC or the AFC North because the AFC North didn't exist back in like the 80s and 90s. Was it the AFC Central? Right. God. So you have to go back then to find. Yeah. So the true kings of the North are obviously the Pittsburgh Steelers. Okay. Have been. And I stand with the old gods. Not these new upcomers who think, you know, trust me, the Steelers are definitely House Stark of the, you know, of the.
That's probably true of the North.
The Browns are trying to be, you know, maybe like the. Like the Boltons here and try to cause an uprising.
Well, yeah, and I just wanted to point out that, like, you know, I'm a Bengals fan, and so my whole thing there was that, like, look, I have more in common, you know, Bengals fans have more in common with Steelers fans than the Browns have with anybody in the league. So sorry. And it's also I live in Ohio. It's the big you know, the Ohio State is playing in the national championship on Monday.
Browns are
playing Sunday night, so it's like, if I were to root against, I still live in Ohio, okay? Matt does not, and so, you know, I got to put up with all these people as I walk around with my Bengals hoodie, giving me a hard time. So I feel like I posted that, but then also, okay, I'm going to support the Browns.
For any Browns fans that would like to give any sort of Bengals fan a hard time, just remind them as that the Bengals have been to 2 Super Bowls and the Browns have been to 0.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's true. That is. Yes. I will. I will. Also, shout out to Lady Jade who said, here in England, we're supporting the Ravens. And I was like, Lady Jade, what is. Now, that's something Matt and I will. What? Will. I don't know if that's just, you know, come on now. Seriously. Yeah. I'm just kidding. I want to give
Ravens,
her a hard time.
Come on now.
Come on now. No, I'm kidding. But I think it's, you know, hey, we have Ravens in the show. So, you know what I mean?
It's true. Yeah, it is. The Ravens might be the most Game of Thrones team.
Yeah, probably maybe. Yeah,
and they're good. I mean, they're always contenders,
right? I mean, at least that's a team in our division.
I think they're winning their game right now.
Probably are. But so, yeah, so big day in Ohio for sports. So I wanted to mention that just prior as we're recording this, kind of getting ready for a big night here. A lot of fun. So feel free to send me whatever hate you want. I'll take it I know right now we have a lot of Ohio listeners and people from the Midwest who are probably raging at Sir Matt because he's a Steelers fan.
They can.
Sometimes you just hate the best.
It's true.
I mean, you know, sorry. It's like, you know, Tom Brady's the GOAT, but a lot of people don't like him. So.
That's true. So is, yeah, certainly it is. You know, other than that, as how, I mean, is 2021 starting off okay? I mean,
oh,
who knows? Geez.
No,
it's a couple days in. I'm still hoping, you know, we said is 2020 Joffrey and 2021 Ramsey. I don't know, man.
I think you literally jinxed everything, and we're going to come back to that moment. No, well, you know what? I mean, I started off 2020 saying it's going to be this year of, like, you know, the year of travel, this year of giving, this year where I was going to, like, meet a lot of our listeners, go to conventions, all this stuff. That's how I started the year off. So I'm hoping if we started a different way here, it's going to, you know, maybe it'll end up a lot better off than where we started, which is great. That would be fantastic. Yeah. Let's get through the hard stuff and you know.
I will say right here publicly on the podcast this week, as I talked about it last week, I did go get my COVID vaccine. I have the I work in healthcare, so I got the first round of it. It's the Moderna one, you know, felt fine. Other than, you know, a lot of people were talking about their arms being sore. Yeah. Like, you know, when you get like a flu shot, your arm's sore for like a day or two. I do feel like it was, and maybe it's just because everybody was talking about it. I was like, maybe, I don't know. I guess it didn't really feel any more sore or anything you know, so everybody took it. Nobody really had any sort of issues or anything. So, I mean,
yeah. Well, all I know is like ever since then, I've been asking
that's all I can say is my experience.
Because, you know, the Wi-Fi is just through the roof over there.
Oh, seriously. So. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Actually, I feel like my Wi-Fi has gone down since I got it. So maybe it's So I will say that to anybody. So anybody, that's at least my experience with it. That's what I'll say about that. Feel fine.
Yeah. And I think, we got like a letter the other day about our vaccine for teachers in Ohio. And I'm sure other people are getting, you know, just depending on what level, where they're given the vaccine. So ours is coming soon and I'm looking forward to that. So, you know, we'll see. Hopefully make things better. So, all right. Well, there's the old update and that's how we're doing. Thanks again for everybody for sending those Ravens in and go Browns. All right. Okay. let's head over to the Maester's study. We've been keeping up on some of these characters from Fire and Blood, from the Targaryen reign. And last time we were talking about Alicent Hightower and her arrival to the court there at King's Landing. And really she's put right in next to the old king, super close. I mean, there as he's dying. I mean, interesting.
She's in the room when he dies.
I mean, is there, wow. You know what? She was also in the room when Viserys died. So I think, right? Or she walks in right after. I mean, you know, what's going on here? There's a correlation. What's going on?
No, that's what I'm saying.
Alicent Hightower, the Hightower, is always in and around something, always near power, always, I think, maybe the masters of the Game of Thrones. If you look at the histories and just how they've been able to keep power, really, even though you've had houses rise and fall and stuff, they're like, yeah, we're going to stay in that upper tier for a while. We're just going to stay right there. They're an interesting house. We'll have to do a whole kind of house study on them at some point. But Alicent is, you know, she eventually catches the eye of King Viserys Targaryen, who, you know, his first wife is Emma Arryn, who died in childbirth. The small council is then kind of urging him to wed again, you know, and he is ignoring that advice at first. They kind of keep pushing this, and he eventually chooses Alicent Hightower as his wife, and they marry in 106 AC. some people really felt like maybe I kind of wonder if this is an element in the show where Otto Hightower, you know, is. Does he do something, or does he put Viserys in a spot where he feels like he owes Otto something, or he, you know, there's enough room that you could do something, have some conversation where maybe Viserys feels like he owes Otto Hightower and marries his daughter. You know what I mean? I don't know, but he definitely wanted that, and he wanted to have his grandsons or his grandchildren to become, you know, kings. He wants to marry in. This is about as close as they get. Alicent Hightower is right there with the Targaryen king now. And so there's that. Let's see. Did we talk about this? I think we touched on this last time. But the doubts and the whispers and the rumors kind of surrounding Alicent's virtue. And rumors circulating that she had maybe possibly given her maidenhead to Prince Daemon. Right? I forgot about that. Yeah, that's according to Mushroom, right?
Right, and then having slept with King Viserys while Queen Emma Aaron, right, is still alive. So
wow.
And that's something that's going to be really interesting in this show is, man, what route do you go down? Do you leave things, a lot of things open to interpretation? Do we just flat out show them? Because so much of this history is told through us through two totally different perspectives, right? In that you have Mushroom, who's saying one thing, and you have the author of this whole thing, which is Maester Yandel, mm-hmm. right? Writing this history. What's gonna, you know, how are they gonna decide to make these decisions?
Well, I think it's kind of a cool idea to say, let's just give some outline and structure here from our author, George R. R. Martin. And then from there, the show does make these, like, that's where they're going to make some of these calls and these big reveals are going to happen. So that way, if you've read this, there's still stuff that you can, it's not like you know everything, because it would be very interesting if Alicent, you know, like we said, she was in there with the old king when he died, and also they're very close, catching the eye of Viserys. And it just so happens then that his first wife dies, but maybe he was, you know, she dies in childbirth, but was there more to it? I mean, is there, you know, is there something else going on? Is there another mm-hmm. reason why Emma Aaron died in childbirth? Is Alicent just, I don't know. I mean, that's something to look into. Or Otto Hightower involved? I mean, who knows? They could do a lot of that kind of stuff. And that is all straight speculation. There's no necessarily backing for that in the books, but we're just kind of touching on where they could expand in the TV show. So I think it, you know, pretty interesting. But another element here in this marriage early on, you know, she is close with her stepdaughter, Princess Rhaenyra Targaryen. But it's after the birth of Alicent's first son, Prince Aemon, and then she goes on to have other children as well, that this tension arises between her and Princess Rhaenyra, because Princess Rhaenyra is named the heir. She is like the realm's delight. And Viserys does love his daughter very much, has kept her around. She's a cupbearer, all that good stuff. And now, you know, Alicent and Otto Hightower, they don't like that. They want to go back to this precedent that was set in 101 AC, where it should be the male heir. She may be the elder female, right? Offspring of Viserys Targaryen, but doesn't matter, because now he has had a son with Alicent Hightower, and that individual should be next in line. And so that's where this gets tricky, and we start to have issues, because people have already pledged their allegiance to Rhaenyra. So what do you do now, right? I mean, I think that's a problem. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be something, again, interesting to see in the show, right? I think that's where it's going to be, really these two that are going to be like our maybe Catelyn and Cersei, right? You think early in Game of Thrones, That's who they're ultimately it's gonna feel like is those are gonna be really, I think, the two kind of leads of the show.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah, and so yeah, that'll be where they have to focus things. Yeah, for sure. So another, let's move on here a little bit. This growing tension continues, and it grows to the point where I kind of feel like we're going to get a lot of Otto Hightower maybe having conversations with Viserys, talking about why his grandson should be named the heir and sent maybe even to Dragonstone, symbolically to represent that next up in line. That's where Rhaenyra is, actually. She's away from King's Landing. And I think it's, is it 5 years, their fifth anniversary of King Viserys' marriage to Queen Alicent, you have this tourney. And in 111 AC, you have a great tourney that was held in their honor, and you get sort of these factions, the Greens and the Blacks. The Greens represent the Hightowers, who are kind of pushing for, you know, their claim to the throne, and you have Rhaenyra and her supporters who are wearing black. And so that's sort of the beginnings of all of this. Let's see. In the tourney itself, the Greens were defeated by the Blacks when Sir Criston Cole, wearing Rhaenyra's favor, unhorsed all of the Queen's champions, including two of her cousins and her youngest brother, Sir Gawain Hightower. So foreshadowing, Sir Matt? I mean, mm-hmm. is there some foreshadowing there? But then you've got Sir Criston Cole, who's such an interesting character, who is, again, you know, wearing the Queen's favor. Why is he wearing, or I'm sorry, he's wearing Rhaenyra's favor, defeats Queen Alicent's people, and we know that Sir Criston Cole will later on take the side of Alicent Hightower. And you're like, so because he and Rhaenyra had a falling out. We're gonna do a whole episode on Sir Criston Cole because he's fascinating. All right, and so Prince Daemon, we haven't brought him up yet. So Prince Daemon Targaryen, so Viserys' brother, he is also opposed to Alicent and her sons. After his return to King's Landing, he made fun of Alicent, Aegon, and Aemon, and the other Greens to entertain Princess Rhaenyra. It is said he acted cool towards the princes, Aegon and Aemon, because they had pushed him even lower, or cruel, I'm sorry. He had acted cruel towards them because they pushed him even lower in the line of succession. And so that is the interesting piece. At first, this is where I think he's going to be an interesting character. He is calling out, or he's mocking Viserys' unborn, or the heir for a day, right? Emma Aaron's children. And he's always doted on Rhaenyra, but I think it's because, you know, she is, again, he thinks he could possibly marry her. There's that whole situation too, which eventually he will. And he comes back, and once he's in kind of good graces with Viserys, he is now mocking the Greens, really showing where his allegiance is. And that's a big deal. I mean, had he have sided with the Greens, it's over. Rhaenyra is sorry. But it's a big deal that the king's brother is siding, you know, with his daughter. So, all right, let's see. When Rhaenyra turned 16, the small council started looking for a suitable husband. Alicent had her own choice, her eldest son, Prince Aegon. Now think about that. While the princess was still 16 years old, he was only 6 years old himself. Viserys argued that the siblings had never gotten along, but Alicent urged her husband and said that that was all the more reason to wed the two. Viserys refused, believing that Alicent only made the suggestion to get her own blood on the throne. No kidding. War could have been averted here. That's the big deal, right? Is that it's actually probably a good idea. They both then, I mean, this happens with Targaryens, brother and sister, marry, right? And they continue that bloodline and they're, you know, carry on that Targaryen lineage. And now House Hightower will be closely, you know, married, grafted in there, right? So, I mean, it's interesting because of how bold House Hightower was in trying to make this move. You don't really hear like House Aaron, right? Because we know Emma Aaron's daughter is Rhaenyra. So House Aaron, my friend, right? Like from the Vale, they're very closely married in with the Targaryens, and this is a chance for them to be close to power. And we don't really hear a whole lot about them. We really hear more. We will later. We will once we get into the dance. But we hear a lot about the Hightowers making this bold push. And I think had there not been a lot of drama beforehand, and if he hadn't had to send Sir Otto Hightower away, maybe Viserys would have agreed to this and had married his son and his daughter together. That might have happened. But since there was a lot of bad blood between him and Otto Hightower, it just doesn't go that way. So, yeah. Let's see, a couple more things here. So we attempted that. By the time Princess Rhaenyra got married in 114 AC, Queen Alicent had found a new member for her Greens, Sir Criston Cole, as we talked about. Former companion to Princess Rhaenyra, Criston fought in the tourney for Rhaenyra's wedding with Alicent's favor and was named Alicent's personal sworn shield soon after. So how does this guy go from serving Rhaenyra to then shifting over to serve Queen Alicent? And there's, again, Mushroom, the Septon, the Maester, they all kind of, yeah, they got some ideas on how maybe that went down, right? Then by 115 AC, there's so much just animosity between the Greens and the Blacks that's growing deeper and deeper. Whilst Alicent had given birth to Prince Daeron, who, just like his brothers and sisters, looked unmistakably like a Targaryen, Princess Rhaenyra had given birth to Prince Jaehaerys and Lucerys, who both looked nothing like either Rhaenyra or her husband, Ser Laenor Velaryon. That is a problem, my friend. Why is that a problem? There's tons of rumors that Ser Laenor Velaryon doesn't share her bed, and perhaps shares a bed with someone else, a close companion of his, and that Rhaenyra may even be sharing the bed of Ser Harwin Strong, and again, Otto Hightower was replaced by a Strong for Hand. Just crazy. Just absolutely crazy. But in 120 AC, Alicent's second son became involved in an incident where Rhaenyra's son, Lucerys, took out Aemon's right eye. Alicent, angered, demanded that Lucerys, that the same be done to him. After this incident, King Viserys declared that Alicent and her children would remain at court in King's Landing, whilst Rhaenyra and her family remained at Dragonstone. So he separates the two, keeps the grandkids away from each other. His children. He's got grandkids intermixing with his kids. Yeah, so there's that. You know, Rhaenyra's kids are his grandchildren. Later that year, Rhaenyra gave birth to her first son by Prince Daemon. Alicent grew wroth, learning the child had been named Aegon, believing it to be a slight against her own firstborn, who also had the name Aegon. And so that's where we'll get this Aegon the Elder, Aegon the Younger situation, mm-hmm. The young dragon. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he will end up becoming Aegon the Third. Right. And so it's kind of weird, ultimately, that this big, huge power struggle that goes back and forth and back and forth. And then where does it ultimately end up? Well, Rhaenyra ends up winning, you know, kind of, you know, it's like she doesn't, but her son. So it's really great. And I the Dance of Dragons, I think, I think on television, I feel like the Blackfyre Rebellions would be cooler. Mm-hmm. Just because it feels like a totally outside faction, whereas this is more like Civil War. Even though it is, it's just because they like move over to Essos, right? But it's gonna be a lot. It's gonna be a lot of backstabbing. It's gonna be a lot of political intrigue. And for people who have no idea what happens, I still think it could be more intriguing than Game of Thrones for viewers. Absolutely. Of the show.
Well, I think you and I would be blown away if all of a sudden we found out that Alicent Hightower killed Emma Arryn. If they did that, not that they're, and again, you're like, well, where is it coming from? And that's just total, there's room for it. What I'm saying is there's a void where in which you could do something like that if you wanted to. So if they do that, would we all not be like, wait, what? And then we go back to the pages and we look and we say, well, they just said she died in childbirth. And then we find out that, you know what I mean?
She's murdered in childbirth or something.
Yeah, I mean, that it's more than that.
And I'm not at all saying this is going to happen. 100% not saying this is going to happen. But keep in mind, really, if this, because they haven't even necessarily said if this is going to be, we don't know yet, if it's 100% in line canon with the show. Like, are they just creating a show canon, right? Mm-hmm. They could change the ending of this. Because I don't know in Game of Thrones that they ever specifically say, maybe in some of the special features, but I don't think there's ever, you know, because they'll briefly bring up the way some of this stuff goes down. But I mean, because it happened so long ago, there's nothing to say that that Rhaenyra might lose, right? And they,
yeah,
I never know. What you're saying. I'm not saying that they're going to do that at all, but I'm saying they could. I mean, heck, look what they decided to do with season 8, right? I mean, they could just be like, no, we think this is going to make better television. This is the way we're going to go.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and that's where I'm saying, you know, kind of brace yourself for what might be them deviating from what we think. I mean, I guess when you look at the time jumps and the gaps, you know, in this 5 years of their marriage, you know, like how are we going to show what happened between Alicent and Viserys? What happens when Alicent first shows up? I mean, are we going to explore that? Is this someone who is sharing, as you said, actually sharing Viserys' bed and Daemon's, you know, bed? Was there some plot to maybe take out Viserys and have Alicent be with Damon, you know, like all of that. I mean, Otto Hightower, what is he doing? Is he scheming to that level? Are we actually going to, you know, see what that looks like? And there is nothing in the text that says that that's happening, but there's enough room for it to happen is the way I look at it. And if people want to argue that, send a freaking raven, okay? I'm all for it. I just I want to speculate about the show, and I like to think of ways in which they could take even people who have read Fire and Blood and say, guess what? We're going to turn that on its head or show you something that wasn't in the books and kind of, you know, go from there. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ez. Let's move on over to the reread. Today we are into Catelyn 6. Let me make sure I'm getting my Roman numerals correct there. Yes, Catelyn 6 of A Clash of Kings. So today, Catelyn reflects on how she has always done her duty, remembering that she never comforted Littlefinger after Brandon had injured him, nor did she bid him farewell when her father sent him off. Later, Maester Vyman shows her a letter from Elwood Meadows, the new Castilian at Storm's End. The man does not make note of Edric Storm, and she wonders again why Stannis is so interested in the boy, thinking he might mean to use the boy's appearance as proof of Joffrey's ill heritage. Catelyn is considering the nature of bastards and their fathers, and recalls Roose Bolton's recent missive where he calls his bastard Ramsay Snow a boy of tainted blood, and that he counts himself well rid of him. Bolton states that he hopes Robbs will weigh his capture of Harrenhal against the crimes of his bastard son. Catelyn is drawn away as fighting begins across the Red Fork, yet each time Lord Tywin's troops attempt to cross, Edmure's men repel them, raining arrows down upon them as they attempt to ford the river. Catelyn is unimpressed, despite the victory her brother has won against one of the most famous battlefield commanders alive. She sends wine to Cleos Frey and then attempts to gain information from him, but knows the man is little of use. As she learns that it is Sir Cleos, saw only Sansa at Course, she, you know, thinks of Arya. Catelyn muses that either Cersei is keeping Arya hidden for fear of what she might say or do, right? She is, you know, certainly aggressive and hard to tame, or that she might be dead. Catelyn does consider Tyrion a man who might be trusted at his word, despite what transpired between the two. She then learns the results of a great victory that Leo Lefford has drowned, and that Gregor Clegane was badly wounded, and that the Great Knight Strongbore has been taken captive. Yet, despite the fact that they are winning, she is still afraid.
As she should be. Right?
Yeah, things seem grim. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of things going on at once here. So the way it kind of starts here. I mean, tell father I've gone to make him proud. Her brother swung up into his saddle, every inch of the lord in his bright mail and flowing mud and water cloak, a silver trout ornament of the crest of his great helm. He's always proud of you, Edmure, and he loves you fiercely for that. I will say, book Edmure is a little bit more. He's definitely, like, the show just makes him out to seem like he's an imbecile. Like, he's an absolute idiot.
I know they do. And I actually am really glad you brought that up, because I was going to start this whole conversation off with, you said this all through Game of Thrones, which is you have to look at the point of view from which the story is being told. And, gosh, man, this is going to hurt for some people. All right, so brace yourself. But the young wolf, I think, makes a mistake, a big mistake, in not telling Edmure Tully what he's doing, what his plans are necessarily. And he just gives him strict instructions to stay at River Run, and you're supposed to obey your king and all this kind of stuff. But like Hattie have said, there may come a time when it seems that Tywin is going to approach and he's going to try to, you know, come take River Run or whatever. Like, he eventually, like, later on, this all kind of comes from, he will chastise Edmure for what he does here. And Edmure thinks he does a good thing, and he's kind of keeping Tywin, you know, back and keeping him away from River Run. And he's going out there using the river and that bank, that high ground to push them back or keep them away. And even Brienne says, like, he's just probing. Then he's going to bring, like, one finger here, one finger here, one finger there. Those fingers will turn into a fist, and then Tywin's going to punch through across the river. And it just doesn't happen that way. I mean, really, what Edmure doesn't know is that Tywin is gotten calls that the young wolf has made his strike. This big has won a victory. Catelyn keeps asking where he's at. Now, I don't know if there was, and I'm trying to think again, whether there was more said, but to me, it's like, your battle commanders, and like that, if it's really important that he's lulling Tywin further and further and further in, so that way he can make his great escape back north and across the Twins later on. Okay, then that would be nice for, I guess, Edmure to know. And I can't really think if there's a reason, and if someone knows the reason and I'm missing it, as to why he doesn't tell Edmure that. Like, just kind of think it's coming up here in a few chapters. But to me, like, you just brought up the fact that they make him out in the show to be this idiot. I mean, as if he just makes so many mistakes and whatever. But, like, people of River Run get behind him. Like, they feel like he's doing a good thing and a good job. And I kind of feel like the young wolf didn't really – maybe he should have told him what he was all – I don't know. I mean, couldn't risk a raven is part of it. I mean, it's risky in sending your plans via, you know, raven when you're in battle like that. Riders are, you know, can they get through? So that's I just want to, in defense, if I can. It's hard to defend him, but I try because I like him. I like River Run, and I like the Blackfish a lot too.
Right. Edmure, show Edmure, or I should say, you know, like, you need somebody to be comic relief because the show is so thick and so heavy. I mean, really, when I think about Game of Thrones, I can really only think about like four or five moments that are actually what you would consider funny, right? You know, and most of that is the Hound. Just, you know, like the Hound chicken scene is like hilarious, but at the same time, you're like, oh my God, like what's about to happen? So, you know, like the first thing, when I think of comedy in the show, like two of the first things I think of are when Edmure is trying to shoot the bow, right? When he's trying to shoot Hoster Tully, you know, as he's sailing off, and the Blackfish is like, here, give me that, and then does it. And then at the very end of the show, where Edmure Tully stands up to be like, I'll be king, you know, and then sit down, right. So you definitely need somebody to be some sort of comic relief in a show which is so thick. He's holding Tywin at bay here.
Well,
I mean, not that it's hard because you're just keeping him from crossing a river, but he's doing what he's supposed to do. And then when you look at it, I mean, Edmure kind of upholds his agreement of the bargain, right? Where he's going to, I'll marry some.
Absolutely.
Some Frey, Frey, and it's Rob, who does it. And actually,
it's like, hold on a second, King Rob, did you not make the ultimate like mess up here? That's where I think about point of view. I mean,
yeah, and there's two things I kind of want to pull out of here today. These are kind of my big takeaways. One, Catelyn talks about how, with the exception of Arya, she feels like most of her children are more Tully than Stark. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd actually almost disagree. I think it's actually I think Rob is more Tully than Stark. And even that includes Sansa, even though Sansa's hair is different, just in their personalities and how they ultimately end up kind of growing up, because, you know, the Tully words are family, duty, honor. There's a great line in here where Catelyn says, you know, how can I do my duty where I do not know where it lies, right? You know, Cat's all for duty except when it's doing stuff for her family. So it's that balance of the three. And oftentimes it is actually honor that gets her in trouble or kind of screws them up, right? You know, like, you know, she releases Jaime, which is for her family, but it's kind of against her duty as Lady for River Run, right? I mean, that's kind of that, it's hard to go up those. So I think often she ends up going family first out of the three. It's not necessarily a balance of, you know, of the three. She marries Ned, which she talks about in here, but again, that's out of,
it's more duty to family. That's
it's duty
of, you know,
yeah,
duty to
exactly family. Yeah. Yeah, she's not really interested in marrying Ned for his honor, right? You know, like, oh, I can be Lady Stark. That's like, you know, I mean, and honor and duty kind of go hand in hand a little bit, right? I mean, mm-hmm. like there's really not a lot of moments where I feel like she does things because it's the right thing to do. And then thinking of her with kind of those things. And so maybe that's ultimately because they're trouble. That's definitely what gets Rob in trouble. Is Rob, his ultimate downfall is that he disregards his honor because he said, oh, I'm going to do this.
Right.
And I mean, I think that's definitely duty is like something that like, well, I was born into this family. This is the thing I have to do. Honor. When you say I'm going to do something and you don't, that's disregarding your honor.
Well, that's what ultimately gets
him in trouble. I mean, Rob marches south because of family. Boom. We're gonna do this whole thing.
Well, and also then, like when he does make a mistake, and he's with Jane. He then says, well, like, since I've probably gotten her with child, like, I'm going to honor compels him to then stay with her. You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to make that right, trying to. And it's tough because he's already pledged himself to someone else. And he has Freys all around him who are super, super ticked. And again, we're kind of speculating across this chapter and into what will be the next Catelyn chapter. But I just went back and looked, and really, Rob, I just don't think he anticipated, you know, I don't know that he shared his battle plans with Edmure, and that's just where I get a little bit kind of frustrated, because if a host is coming near you and you can use that, and he wanted to really pull him in to a trap. I mean, Rob was really trying to pull him in there and was going to use the Frey cavalry and had this big plan. How does Edmure not know about that? Why is he not? I mean, he's given strict and specific instructions as to what to do. I get that. He does publicly praise him because that seems like a good thing. But privately, you know, he and the Blackfish will definitely get on him for it. But anyways, I just say all that because this whole, what we're seeing right now is basically him doing this. Like Catelyn says, you know, yes, we can have some wine. The singers can sing. We can make some songs. But then also the songs are going to have to wait. There's still fighting to do at the end of this chapter because Edmure is supposedly, seemingly, doing a good thing. He doesn't realize that it's just Tywin probing to see where he's at. And also, no one knows here that, like, had he had just let him rush headlong into Rob and his host and right where Rob wanted him, then the battle down at King's Landing could have been a different outcome there with Stannis, because Tywin's able to rally. He gets word from Bitterbridge and from Littlefinger and the Tyrells in time to, you know, change course. So it's just, there's too many different, you know, variables there. And it's wartime. Communication is tough among all these different parties. And I just think I wanted a short little defense of Edmure. Okay. So I know it's going to tick some people off, but you know, it is what it is. And just my thoughts on it. So
no, yeah. I think you're right in defending. And again, there's a difference. The show causes us to, when you first think of him, it's like, oh, okay, well, he's kind of an idiot, but he's not necessarily in the books. And those are some small differences that kind of skew our perspective. And as you said, point of view, right? I mean, that's something else to keep in mind, is that this is from Catelyn's point of view. So Catelyn probably does have a better opinion of her brother than other people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So point of view, we'll pay attention to that as we go along here. I'm trying to think of other big takeaways from this. Well, why don't you talk about, you know, your whole, I mean, just lie after lie after lie. I mean, did you kind of already?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely kind of interesting in that a lot of the stuff in this chapter is there's a lot of foreshadowing. There's a lot of, I didn't highlight them, but I'll see if I can find them here. There's a moment with Roose Bolton where he's talking about how it's best to get rid of Ramsay, right? Like, good riddance to him. Okay, that's obviously a lie. You know, we all know he's plotting behind him and all this stuff. There's a moment where she's talking about the Freys, and she says, you know, a Frey would never betray their word, and then she kind of says, unless it benefits Walder. But I Walder Frey probably would have kept his oath had Rod not broken his.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He stood way more to gain. Walder Frey actually stood way more to gain from Rob marrying his daughter than to try and side with Cersei.
Well, and at this point, it's crazy because they're winning. Harrenhal is taken. There is some stuff going on early on with Roose Bolton, maybe. You know, but still, Walder Frey, I think, yeah, instantly word gets back to him about Jane Westerling, and it's done at that point. As soon as the word gets back there and the Freys leave, he's making plans with Roose and Tywin, and I mean, it's over. It's done.
All right.
It's over.
Really quick what if here. Just because I want to think it out here really quick. We don't have to dive into a huge major discussion. Let's say that Rob did not betray Walder Frey, and we know Stannis is going to the Battle of Blackwater. If Stannis wins there, because Tywin doesn't get to come down, and then a fight turns into, because I think Stannis would say, you're part of the Seven Kingdoms. You're gonna bend the knee. Like it or not, because I think Stannis would then be like, you're either bending the knee or I'm attacking the North. Do you think Rob at that point would be able to win to beat Stannis? You'd have pretty much a united North and Riverrun and all that lined up, and then Dorne would be maybe doing whatever they want.
And here's why. So first of all, the way I kind of was thinking it would go is that if Rob gets back and the Freys stay with him, kind of what happens at that point, if he doesn't marry Jane Westerling, and so he keeps the Freys with him, he has a decision right then and there to make. You know, do you push on down further? I think it would be southwest. To try to get into West, because Tywin's gone back to King's Landing. Does he take advantage of that? Does he keep pressing forward? But he really couldn't because he lost the Freys, and so he has to retreat back to Riverrun. If he doesn't lose the Freys, he has a decision to make: to press on with the Freys or to go back to Riverrun and kind of solidify the North up to the point of Harrenhal. Now, then, if what you're saying is if Tywin does get back there and. Because it seems like, really, if Stannis does win, and in your scenario, if Stannis wins, I think if he wins, then the Lannisters aren't much. There's not much going for the Lannisters. The Tyrells would be like, if Stannis wins, that means he beat the Tyrells and the Lannisters, right?
Yes.
So unless you're saying too that like Tywin didn't, you know, make it back in time. But that would be because Rob pushed on west, because then Tywin would keep following him west. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's where it gets kind of tricky. But if Stannis wins and ultimately defeats the Tyrells and ultimately defeats the Lannisters, then Dorne is hanging out just waiting to see what's happening. And it's really then just Storm's End. And then it's like, what do the remainder of the Tyrells and Lannisters do? Do they submit to Stannis? Mm-hmm. Because then we have a freaking war, you know?
Right. But at this point you still have Balon Greyjoy, who, and Theon's about to take Winterfell,
right?
So it's
that's where Bolton would have stayed. If Bolton stays loyal to King Rob and all that stuff happens, and we don't have a bunch of plotting going down Tywin, then you do have a kind of right there in the middle, right south of the Neck, mm-hmm. and through the Riverlands and over the Vale's not even a player right now, but they would ultimately, you've got Riverrun, Stark connection, Stark loyalty. set up there and established. I think if they're waiting to see this as well. They're kind of like Dorne, waiting to see what's going to happen here. Yeah. They would have.
You know, I don't know that it's ever specifically said, but do you? This is actually a good question. I'm gonna Reddit search this. Does Tywin know that Greyjoy is that Balon Greyjoy is starting to like siege the land, like the coast, that western coast?
I feel like there is some reports that he does know, or that
I can't remember if it's ever said in a chapter, because we don't get like Tywin chapters.
No, I'm trying to. I think I definitely know later on, but I mean, at what point is it? What you're asking? Because like, if you're asking like right now, where we're at in the book series, I would say probably not yet, because Rob was headed to attack the West, thinking that his initial objective is that Theon is going to bring the Greyjoy's fleet down and, you know, on the West as well, and be sort of that attack from the sea, which would keep them close to the coast, and he could come in, you know, on land behind them. So, you know, I don't know that word's got, because what they're doing up there on the Iron Islands was super secret. I know later on it like they definitely know. But right now, at this time, I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah, I'm looking. There, it does look like there's a quote here, but I don't know exactly where it's from. Basically, just talking. It's afterwards, and just talking about Balon. Like basically, let's see if I can do a search for this. Basically, Balon Greyjoy thinks in terms of plunder. Like he's an idiot. Let him enjoy an autumn crown and suffer a northern winter. There'll be no way there's no way he'd be, it's from A Storm of Swords. Like basically no way that he'd be able to hold that land. So it's nothing he has to really worry about.
Yeah. I think the people who first get word of it are the Starks and Rob's host. But I'm sure it's shortly after that Tywin would hear about it too. So I honestly can't remember. And if that's somewhere, then yeah. Let us know, you know, it'd be interesting to think about. I know Rob fully believed in Theon, and he believed, because that was a part of his attack on the West, as he believed he was coming with him. So if he believed that to the point where he commits his forces there, well, then it makes me think, you know, I mean, Theon goes there with the full intent to you know, join up with King Rob. Let's do this. And it's his father who says, no, I don't think so. You've lost the way here. You don't understand. The Ironborn way is different. We're going to be raiding and taking advantage and plundering and doing what we can. So,
yeah, it looks like maybe that's a Tyrion chapter where that's ultimately from, in A Storm of Swords. So just something interesting thing. We talk a little bit about Edric Storm here, and then it causes Catelyn to think a little bit about Jon Snow, and this is where Ashar Dane gets brought up. You know, he is 7 or 8, comely, with black hair and bright blue eyes. Visitors oft thought him Lord Renly's own son. And Renly favored Robert. Catelyn had a glimmer of understanding. Stannis means to parade his brother's bastard before the realm, so they might see Robert in his face and wonder why there is no such likeness in Joffrey. It's a good idea by Stannis, but we know Stannis might have other ideas for him as well. Those who favor Stannis will call it proof. Those who support Joffrey will say it means nothing. Her own children had more Tully about them than Stark. Arya was the only one to show much of Ned in her features. And Jon Snow, but he was never mine. She found herself thinking of Jon's mother, the shadowy secret love her husband would never speak of. Does she grieve for Ned as I do, or did she hate him for leaving her bed for mine? Does she pray for her own son as I have prayed for mine? Those were uncomfortable thoughts and futile. If Jon had been born of Ashar Dane and Starfall, as some whispered, the lady is long dead. If not, Catelyn had no clue who or where his mother might be, and it made no matter. Ned was gone now, and his loves and secrets had all died with him. But then she was struck again by how strangely men behaved when it came to their bastards. Ned had also been fiercely protective of John, and Sir Courtly Penrose had given up his life for this Edric Storm. Yet Roose Bolton's bastard had meant less to him than one of his dogs, to judge from the tone of queer, cold letter Edmure had gotten in the 3 days past. So, and that's where he talks a little bit about, you know, for whatever. And then we all know it's actually a lie, and that Roose has big plans for Ramsay.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's interesting, and I was, it's funny, when you re-listen to the chapter, you catch these little lines, and you think maybe one line means, you know, who knows what, something. But there's a line where Catelyn says, "You know nothing." And I was like, I swear to God. And I, but it's right after she reflects on Jon Snow. So I kind of thought, he's creating the idea, when it comes to Jon Snow, that we, the reader, know nothing. We know nothing about him. And everything we think we know is not true. You know, it's one of those things that he's lacing in there. And she says it in, like, right after she reflects on Bastards and Jon Snow. And I thought, wow, there we go, George. There it is. So, yeah, I mean, so basically, yeah, that's a good thought. I just, net things, everything that we kind of, that she says or thinks about is a little misleading. And it's just her thoughts, right? And if we're buying into those, if we buy into to her thoughts and we believe it, well, that leads to a great surprise later on when everything that Catelyn was thinking about becomes untrue. And it's not even, it was leading us down a path of not falsehood, but I mean, it's literally just her thoughts as a character in the story. And we have to kind of remember that.
Right.
So,
yeah. Okay. Right here. Right. Arise, sir. Catelyn seated herself. I know no grandson of Walder Frey would be an oathbreaker. And then she thinks, unless it serves his purpose. So there's a lot of foreshadowing in here. There's a lot of stuff. But again, Walder Frey isn't only an oathbreaker because Rob is an oathbreaker.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Which is worse? Are you a House Frey supporter right now? What is going on with you?
No.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
I just think. I mean, it's just it's.
Fair is fair. Call it out.
It's so heartbreaking that Rob, to me, it might be the dumbest decision in all of in the whole series.
He was in love, man. He was in love.
Oh, I know. And
Jamie tells us the things I do.
And
for
I
love.
Get it. And I get it.
You know.
Because even, and I know I'm highly critical of him, but even Renly at least has some claim to say, well, Robert took the throne, I can take the throne. Right? Because technically he's initially not saying, I'm taking it from Stannis. He's saying, I'm taking it from Joffrey.
Yeah.
Right? Joffrey is wrong. Even though... Right. But then once Stannis steps and says, once Stannis says I'm in, I have an actual claim. Okay, then that's where I have issue with Renly saying that. But he is still technically right. I mean, you can usurp whoever you want,
right?
In that, but this specific decision, you know, like Catelyn letting Jaime go, she does because she believes it's going to get her family back, and Rob at that point, I mean, Rob could still win the war, right? I mean, Rob is like, I mean, he's soundly beating Tywin. And then once, you know, if Jaime actually does what he says he's going to do, right? So if that actually works out the way it is, then now you have Sansa and Arya back in, assuming that's what actually happens, right? And then that gives you tons of options. I mean, the war could still totally go on, regardless of whether you have actually, and Sansa and Arya, as they say, like, because people say, well, Sansa and Arya aren't, like, you know, people think they're not nearly as valuable as Jaime Lannister. I don't know. I beg to differ. Mm-hmm. If you get both Sansa and Arya back and you give them Jaime Lannister, yeah, they get a battle commander, but we get two potential trading pieces, and let's marry Sansa and Arya off, and now you've got who knows how many more men.
Well, that's exactly what Tyrion tried to do with Myrcella,
exactly.
Baratheon, right, with Dorne, is to make a marriage alliance, and that's, I mean, Tommen is something, you know, again, they're keeping him safe, and they're separating him because he could be another, like you said, if you get him as a hostage, they wanted to keep him safe. So King's Landing is being attacked and you kill Joffrey. We at least got to have somebody who can carry on, which is why later on Rob will get into this whole writing a letter, naming his heir, that whole thing, because yeah, you want to set that up for sure. So yeah, you're right. I mean, I think they're definitely super important. Catelyn commits treason. Let's be honest.
Oh, man. Oh.
You know, it's treasonous. So it's just, it's some really bad decisions, because it's so wild. He's making all the right moves. I mean, air quote, all the right battle moves and winning these battles in these wars. He's catching Tywin off guard. He's doing things unorthodox. He's the legend. It's all kind of spreading and his victory, and he's doing great. And if he gets more and more support, it would have been awesome. But like, it's, yeah, just a couple decisions take us the wrong way. So putting his trust and his faith in Theon, he was warned against that. You know, and then really the Tullys, Edmure and Catelyn, both kind of some mistakes are made. And then he himself makes a mistake with Jane Westerling. Okay. So,
all right. And then, okay, we do get a little bit here of Brienne, which is kind of interesting. Just where, we get a little bit of Brienne's history, right? And like, just talking about like, you know, let them have their songs if it makes them brave. Catelyn thought, toying with her silver goblet. There was always a singer at Evenfall Hall. When I was a girl, Brienne says, I learned all the songs by heart. Sansa did the same. You know, I told her there would be singers at the king's court. I told her she would hear music of all sorts, that her father could give her a master to help her learn the harp. Oh, gods, forgive me. The Brienne says, I remember a woman. She came from across the narrow sea. I could not say even what language she sang in, but her voice was as lovely as she was. She had she had eyes the color of plums. Okay. That should raise everybody's eyes, huh? And her waist was so tiny, my father could put his hands around it. His hands were almost as big as mine. She said, you know, did you sing for your father? Never, you know, his fool made cruel japes, you know, at her sometimes like that. Someday you must sing for me. Well, I think she's gonna in Winds of Winter when Brienne gets, you know, brought back to her, you know, and then it just kind of goes on from there though. But I do think that's interesting though. Just the that line kind of caught my attention, in that hey, this woman gets brought over and she has eyes the color of plums.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, I just went. You know what I just did is I went and.
Is there big theories as to who she is?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a couple we'll look at after the well after
doesn't
the show.
Doesn't Septa Lamore have eyes the color of plums?
Something. Yeah, are we making the Shara Dane connections, or what are we doing here? You know,
I mean, you never know. I mean, she if she's Septa Lamore,
yeah, I've never really looked into Selwyn much. Just to see, you know, who are those individuals that are showing up, and yeah, who this particular individual is. Brienne's mother is kind of a mystery, right?
Well, I don't think Tarth. I don't think that's
no, Brienne's I know yet. It's not. I know it's not. That's what I'm saying. Like, there's nothing said on her mother or even women.
But we know that at some point she comes from Duncan the Tall, so mm-hmm. his line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think her eyes are violet. But yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then it ends just like we said in the summary. They're just getting more news about the marching and stuff like that. And everything sounds like it should be going good, but she is still afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, as we said, as she should be, because there's,
the night is dark.
It's right. Yep. full of tears. You know, unless River Run has some ancient fish god that they can believe in, I don't know. Right. The seven aren't answering. The old gods, although they're ancient, they're not saying much. They're just listening. So, you know. All right. Well, is that it? Anything else from the chapter?
No, those are kind of my big takeaways of it today.
Okay. All right, well, let's move over to Ascenda Raven, and we have one here from Sir Ryan. Always good to hear from Sir Ryan. I can't remember if we read this one or not. I know you and I kind of discussed it off the podcast for sure. This was following one of our Zoom chats, which, again, for Bannerman, are a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun there on the New Year's Eve. Fantastic time. But he said this beforehand, and I really can't remember if we talked about it or not. If we did, you know, forgive me, I guess. He said, you know, you two keep speculating that that Gurm may need to expand the final two books into three to tie up his loose ends. Are these loose threads? My question is, what would the third book title be? We know these future two have names that tie together. Would he keep the added book title theme similar to Winds, or would he jump to a summer, title? Or could he go into a completely different direction? We have no hints to help us on this should the opportunity arise. So I thought this would be a fun conversation for you two. And it is always fun for me to kind of say, I don't know how we finish this book, this series in two books. I have literally no clue. George has said it for several years. It's gotten away from him that the series has actually taken off and the story has gotten away from him, meaning there are threads that go out. He's actually doing revisions. He's rewriting. I think he's trying to use an economy of words, trying to streamline some stuff. I think he's getting a little too wordy. I think exactly what I thought was going to happen is happening. And I think he has said, I've got to figure out, he's writing it and he's saying, this is turning into two books. I think that's what's happening. I think he's literally
That's what happened with A Feast for Crows and Dance of Dragons.
Exactly. It's happened before. The whole thing started off as a daggone trilogy. Supposed to be a trilogy. His original pitch is like a trilogy. And it's evolved and it's changed. If you look at the evolution of the series, it just keeps changing on him. So no wonder he couldn't tell Dan and Dave what the ending's going to be. He doesn't know. He doesn't know. Okay? If he knew, he'd write it.
Right, which is fine. I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily matter.
And I say let him write it.
No, you're fine. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Winds of Winter is next. That's all I know. If he wants to include another book in there and call it something else, and then you still have A Dream for Spring that gets pushed to be the final book, or it is A Dream for Spring, and then he's like, well, maybe I'll finish it with something like this. That's fine, too.
You know, what if it's not Winds of Winter? What if he says, you know,
no, Winds of Winter is dead.
No, what if, though, he says, you know what, I had to split this. Just like with, what was, so the original book, Dance of Dragons, what was it supposed to be?
Well, A Feast for Crows was too big and had to get split into A Feast for Crows and A Dance of Dragons.
So you're saying he would keep Winds and then expand, then he'd have an in-between book. And what Ryan is pointing out is that those two, Winter and Spring seem to be such a good complement for the ending of your series.
So do you
you drop in something in the middle that would say something else? Or do you push the events, what he's written for Winds, and say, you know, a lot of this stuff is more like I was building to Winds, and Winds of Winter is the second half of the book. Do you then make that the second half?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
And then is the first half.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it because a lot of the places he keeps writing about are like Tyrion, and a lot of the stuff that's going on in the south and Essos, and not as much stuff that's going on up in the north.
Yeah, look at all the characters. Look at all the chapters that have been released. And look at those characters. Mm-hmm. And then also, and again, I don't know if those are in order or what the whole deal is there, but it's at least enough that he felt like he could release it. And it was early enough that it wasn't spoiler. It wasn't late in the book series. So if a lot of the beginning stuff is going to be centered around, you know, all of this stuff happening in the south and moving Dany, you might have to tell a whole other arc with the south, with these southern realms.
Even to get it to end, let's just say, just for sake of argument, that it ends the same way the show does, right? And so we have to resurrect John, which that could happen in the first 10 chapters. I mean, that's easy. I think resurrecting John is two chapters. It could be a Davos chapter and then one Melisandre chapter, right? I mean, that's boom. You can do that. That's easy. As is like, oh, I don't know. I'm just saying, just for sake of argument, I'm just
grinning because it's always fun.
Right. Just for sake of argument and to make this as easy as possible. So there's two chapters. Arya is actually somebody who's going to take a lot of time to do, I think, because she's blind. You've got to get her to fight the waif, say, I'm leaving, get on a ship, sail back, right? So I think Arya's arc in A Winds of Winter is actually pretty. I think we're going to get like a lot of her, and then we're not going to see Arya for a very long time, and it'll be like 10 or 20 chapters before we get another Arya chapter.
You know, like, right. I'm with you, man. You just caused like, me you, to think, yeah.
You, like, I'm just thinking in terms of how you would pace it. Because that's, like, you get that with, like, in this book, you get that with Theon. And that it's mm-hmm. like, oh, we've only had, like, two Theon chapters. Yeah. But there's a lot of stuff that's going on. And so I think she is a character where, okay, well, we need, at some point, she's got to come back. So what are you going to have, like, four or five, you know, you're going to have one chapter where she sails? I mean, I just think, I think that's how I would pace her. Is I'd have maybe like five chapters in the first, I don't know, half of the book, and then she's gone, and then she shows up at like the very end. Uh-huh. I think is how I would probably do Arya's chapter. Now where you'd have to really the outside characters of the show is where you really have to figure out how do you do that. I mean, I just don't think we're killing young Griff off like early. I think he's around to stay, and you know, we don't know how that's going to figure out, but I mean, just in terms of where we, just assuming his arc goes in some sort of a direction to get to the show, to the very end, he goes to Storm's End, seems likely he's going to take it, and then wherever we decide to go from there, whether it's straight to King's Landing or something else, then maybe he and Cersei get married, and then that's maybe Cersei could still blow up the Sept of the Baelor to get rid of the High Faith, and you could do that in the first third of the book, and then you have Aegon come in, young Griff come in, and then his force is too big, and the people are against Cersei, and so there you have the Mummer's Dragon, and I guess it's not necessarily whatever. I mean, I don't know. So maybe that's how you do that. You line up the Mummer's Dragon with Cersei, and it's not Euron that she ends up kind of marrying in the finale, because Euron's his own deal. And then somehow you have to get to the end of the, and then Stannis could be defeated. There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot, but I mean, I'm thinking, so I mean, I'm just trying to think of,
yeah.
You know, how do you, I think you could fit a lot of that into one book. I think there's going to be a lot of characters you're not going to have POVs for. I think you could do, so if like, let's say Rickon doesn't die, in like the Battle of the Bastards, then do you have one or two chapters of Davos going to Skagos? I think that's easy. And then Rickon shows up after Winds of Winter.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? So, to our listeners, I would encourage you to, on that podcast player, go back 30 seconds to a minute, listen to everything Sir Matt just said, and think to yourself, does that sound... How many chapters? And then think, does that sound like Winds of Winter? You know, that's why I love this whole thought. Because what I'm hearing and what I'm thinking is, when I look at the show, and you said, let's say we paralleled the show, everything that happens in season 8 and then even season 7, buddy, that sounds like Winds of Winter. Like, that sounds like there's some stuff right. happening in the north. The winds of winter are blowing, and man, I mean, stuff is happening right there at the end, which will then be the front end of a Dream of Spring,
mm-hmm.
which is your final kind of book. There's so much that's going to be going on here that, to get us to what sounds like a Winds of Winter, I don't know. It just, I think there's almost enough in what you said all that stuff that you talked about, Arya, Daenerys, Euron down at the Old Town, Sam, King's Landing and Cersei, Aegon, doing his thing. There's enough going on there and all of that that we haven't even we haven't even touched the North. I mean, so right. I don't know. You know, I think that's where I sometimes sit and go, wow, he has got to. And again, not that one title is going to be all this. Everything has to be about like the North. It doesn't. That's not what I'm trying to say. Right. But there's just a lot of threads. There's a lot to cover and a lot to put into two books.
So, I think it's possible in two books, but
it is possible for sure.
It is possible, and the way you do it is you obviously tell a lot of story in one POV, right? I mean, that's ultimately the thing is as we said, there's not a lot of Sansa chapters because Sansa's story is told in Ned chapters and Arya chapters. And then in A Clash of Kings, it's really mostly told in a lot of Tyrion chapters. And so that ends up happening a lot in which you won't have a lot of care. I mean, Rob never has a POV. Rob's story is told to us entirely, for the most part, I'd say about 90%, through Catelyn chapters, right? Except for some of those early Game of Thrones chapters. So, there's a lot of that. You know, when there's going to be, if it does go the same as the show, I mean, if it does go the same as the show, look at how much you can tell of Jon's story through Daenerys or Sansa or Davos or even Theon. I mean, there's a lot of Jon's story that can be told through Melisandre. There's a lot that can be told through another character. So a lot of these moments will be in other characters' point of view. And so that is really where you kind of like push this story forward.
I agree with you. It's possible. It's possible until you start seeing things like new points of views from Arianne Martell. And you're like, wait a second. Now we have a whole new character who is actually taking us. And there are none of our like, I mean, who are our main cast that we're following through her eyes? I haven't met, I mean, there may be one or two. There's not many. Mm-hmm. It's you're telling a whole Dorne arc through her. That's a whole new arc.
Do you think he can, with all of the extra stuff in the book, do you think he can finish it in three books?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think definitely. Yeah.
I think it's even possible to fit it in two books, which is what he's trying to do. I think it's stuff like you're saying, you're going to have to. And by the way, to Sir Ryan and everyone, I actually feel like we have had this conversation many times, but the reason we do is because I just think it's fascinating, the process in which you go about this. And when I've been saying it for years, there's so many threads that when I would talk to show watchers only, and I would say, just wait till you get in the books and you're going to see how complex this is. And you're going to see how he's not even close to the end of this story yet. And with two major books coming, hasn't been able to finish it. It's not coming to him easily. Because he has, I mean, the web has been building outwardly, and you have to, as you said, tie it up into a nice little neat bow. He's still expanding. You know what I mean? Right. He's still touching places like Dorne and things like that, and he's growing that. So that makes it hard to bring it all back together. That's my whole point. He's a master writer, but...
Right. And then the biggest thing in terms of finishing it is, you know, just assuming things end up going some sort of direction like they do in the show, it's the outside characters, because you don't just want to kill them. It's not just like, I need to kill this person off so I can finish. It's no, you need to finish their story. And that's what Gurr is doing and I've said this before and I'll say it again. It's one of the things it's my biggest criticism of the final Harry Potter book. I just feel like in the first 10 chapters, it's more like she was like, I have to finish this and I'm just going to start killing characters off. I mean, like if spoilers, if you haven't seen the last two Harry Potter books or read, I mean, in that first like 10 chapters, right. When Harry is, escaping, right. I mean, she kills off like 10 characters in the matter of like three paragraphs. And it's like, hold on a second, man. And some of their deaths feel so fast, like Hedwig, for example, right? I mean, Hedwig is a very important character to Harry, and during that escape, Hedwig's just killed. Oh, Hedwig died. There you go. And I never ever liked it. And I don't think like that's something Gurr is going to do, because a lot of his deaths have meaning and they're important and like they're very specific. So I think Lady Stoneheart is a character that I don't think is making it to the end, but you can't just kill her off. Like she's important.
Yeah. So just to use your example very quickly of Harry Potter, Hedwig, is there any foreshadowing that owl is going to die, make a sacrifice like that? Not really.
Or Mad Eye.
Is there any like groundwork done prior to that would say in a reread, wow, look at that. We didn't see that coming in a first initial
Exception, you know what I mean? With the exception of the only death I feel like that was really explored in that series was, and I forget which one, is it George that dies? It's one of the twins that dies.
Yeah, I don't know.
I always forget which one it is. But one of the twins dies, right? The Weasley twins dies during that whole deal. And that one is like built up. I mean, like, cause I don't know. That one was like the one that hit the hardest. And I feel like it's because they spend time afterwards to be like, oh my God, like this happened. You know what I mean? Like this happened and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. And so all the characters who die in George's series, like he's been, as you said, writing their story and he laid a bunch of groundwork. Mm-hmm. He kind of told us what's going to, I mean, he's telling us that the saddest sound is the bells. He's telling us about the bells ringing. He's telling us all along that the bells will ring one day and it will be a sad sound and something's going to happen. And we look back in a reread and we go, holy smokes, this guy's been crafting this since the beginning. So,
actually, I think that he has it's actually kind of, if you look at, say, Harry Potter, it's actually kind of a great kind of parallel, because she started writing the books. I think they were on the fourth book when the first movie came out. And so then she's like, all right, I need to finish this because the movies are coming out and they're coming out like every other year. So she does finish the book series before the movies. But that's long past for Gurr now. So now he can. And so did the final book suffer a little bit from, I mean, the rest of the book, I think, is great, of Deathly Hallows. I think it's great. It's like so cool. They explore all this different stuff. But it's really just that first block where I'm like, oh my God, this is happening so fast.
Matt's now trying to save all of our Harry Potter listeners from.
I've criticized it before. But so now Gurr is in the situation where the show's over. So you don't have to race to finish this, other than that you're getting older every day. But you don't have to race to finish it in terms of like, I need to block this to make it finish before the show.
Yeah. No, I'm just teasing you. I mean, like it is interesting, because they have that extra element where those individuals, those authors, were involved, you know, to some degree in making, whether it's a TV show or a movie or whatever, you know, and how does that complicate things, and does that affect your writing process? And, you know, I think it's interesting. So I don't know. Whether you call it Winds of Winters or Winds of Winter, or you call it something else, I just want another book to come out, and I hope he's if he's revising stuff, that means he found something that's better, and he found a way that makes more sense to him as a writer. And you look at that and you go, well, wow, what was the other version that he was working on? The revisions, are they small? Are they minor? Mm-hmm. Is he redrafting? Well, you know, how much is he redrafting?
And keep in mind, okay, so think about this for a second. So A Feast for Crows is 45, 46 chapters, I guess, if you count the prologue. A Dance of Dragons is 71 chapters plus an epilogue plus a prologue. So there's 73 chapters. Mm-hmm. Yep. And those were supposed to, like, he was writing that as one thing. Not to mention the chapters that are getting pushed to Winds of Winter that were supposed to be in that book.
That's right.
So you're talking what, like 120, 150 chapters that he probably had written out for one book that have been spread across three?
Yeah. So in his mind, one book, and that's what I'm saying, over and over, he's shown that like what he thinks fits into one book, ultimately the editor and everyone else says, look, no way. Robert Jordan ran into the same problem with Wheel of Time. What he thought was going to be one book was three. His final book ended up being three books. And so, you know, that's what happens. I mean, there's just so much more story to tell, and you don't want to rush it. And you're like, well, people have bought in here now. That's why I keep saying, let him write, let him revise, let him finish it, give him whatever he needs, quit distracting him with other projects and things. Let him do his thing. If he doesn't want to finish it, he doesn't finish it. You know, it is what it is. But I would love for him to. It's his life.
And I know we've talked about this. Do you think Winds of Winter ends with the wall coming down or like the or whatever? Or...
Nah, I mean, because see, you know, the wall came down because an ice dragon, you know,
right in the show
was so, you know, I don't know that it's actually because you have people who read this series and believe a meteor is going to strike and hit the wall and take it down. You have a large vast majority of the fans.
I think it's the horn because that's what's on the cover.
And there's the horn, so I don't think it's any. I don't even know that I'd have to really pencil out all the different plot lines and go through it, which we've kind of done. We've tried to do a little bit, but I don't know where you end it. It might need to be something epic like that, though. That would be a big. You're thinking of like a big final point to end on, like the Dothraki showing up for Daenerys is a big kind of, you know, deal. Lady Stoneheart, Catelyn returning. Was in the epilogue was a big deal. I mean, at the end of Dance, you have a Varys showing his hand and killing Kevin Lannister. So that's a big deal.
See, and the issue is, I think the issue is that if this book is Winds of Winter, so it almost needs to be North heavy. And what's going on there with Stannis and Rant and all those guys? And right now, he seems like he's in the beginning of of all the chapters he's talking about that he's like said. I wrote a chapter about this. I did an episode on Patreon where I broke down and said these are all of the chapters that we know about. And it all sounds like it's at the beginning of the book.
Well, I'm telling you right now. I'll make my bold prediction right now. There is to answer Sir Ryan's question. Winds of Winter will be the second to last book, but there's a book coming first that doesn't have a title. We're going to get it. I don't know what it's going to be called, but there's going to be a title, something brand new. It's bold prediction. Mark it down. What is today? January 10th. As we're recording this, it is, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So Sir Ezra, making a bold prediction. All right.
Well, here we go. All right. Well, here we go, Ez, because I got a response to, so I posted a video here, will Bran's Tower of Joy vision happen in the Winds of Winter? So I did a YouTube video on that, and I explained a lot of reasoning. So that's something we see at the end of season 6, the episode titled "The Winds of Winter," right? In which Bran, Weirwood's into the Weirwood Network, and he sees the vision. He sees Jon, Lyanna, the Tower, Hal and Reed, save the day, and then Jon is afterward that proclaimed King of the North. So I said, will this happen in Winds of Winter? And I went through all the different scenarios. I said, well, maybe not, because there's characters like Howland Reed who could show up and tell us that information. John Connington could go, he has grayscale. Is he going to fill that Jorah Mormont role, go over and talk to Sam? And that's how we learn of it. So there's reasons we may not see it. Then I said, there's stuff that it may go down differently, because what if, Rhaegar is still alive, or what if, they don't fight there? What if there's tons of different things? So, had a cool response here from Eric, saying he doesn't think it's going to happen. He says, though I'm a Ned plus Ashara equals John supporter, the scene in the show feels more like a bit of fan service for a cheap twist and shock for fans, though it may feel like that because of dropped storylines. I mainly don't see it happening, though, because I logically don't see why Bran's story would involve looking back to find out who Jon's mother is. If the books are going in the same direction as the show in making Bloodraven and the children fighting against the others, I'd imagine Bloodraven showing him the mysteriousness of how the possible failures of how the others were defeated, how they may be held for, how they were held for another 8,000 years, or properly defeated, and not who John was born to. If R plus L equals J is true, the prophecies do play out. Therefore, the prince who was promised is, in the Song of Ice and Fire. I could potentially see it happening, but even then, still unlikely. How John's parentage could come out is something I don't know, but special people don't always need special backgrounds. And as much as I like the Ned plus Ashara equals John theory, I don't like the idea of John just being Ned's bastard, and he doesn't talk about John's mother because he might have accidentally slept with another man's wife, all for that. After all, if John is Rhaegar's son, how can Ned not have thought about Rhaegar in years like he thinks in Game of Thrones, if he was raising his son? Seems rather daft that you would raise your nephew without ever thinking of his parents, you know, a couple times, even if it had been years. So, you know, there's a lot of reasoning he's saying here. So do you think we're going to get that? Do you think we're going to get that flashback to what actually happened? Now, the information, again, could be told to us in a different manner, but will it be through a Bran vision is kind of the question.
Yeah. Okay. So, I'll give my answer. I don't think I actually know your answer. Like, well, I don't think I actually heard whether you said yes or no to that. So I think that the reason why Bran would is that, yes, Bloodraven is taking him to big events like 8,000 years ago, how the children, and trying to show him other things, the prophecies and things building towards whatever. Who knows what all Bloodraven wants to show him. But it seems like when we get in there, Bran wants to visit people that are close to him. He ends up back at Winterfell. He goes to places that are familiar, and he may go back to his father and try to follow his father, and he may and Hallen Reed. He has the Reeds with him. So if there's a way to do it, that would be interesting. I also wonder though, like Tower of Joy, does there have to be a Weirwood? I don't remember a Weirwood there for him to kind of see. Is that part of why in the lore, it's why they cut him down, right? Because they felt like that was the eyes and the ears by which the children were able to kind of learn about their enemy and know when they were going to strike when and where. So, you know, at the Tower of Joy, do you have to have that? Or is Bran's visions beyond? Is his power something more that supersedes the Weirwood network? And he's doing things already, according to the show, that you can't do. You know, you're not able to go back and actually influence events and things like that. And Bran does. So anyways, you know, that I kind of think maybe he would, if he's able to, I think he would. Why? Because really it's more about his father. The Reeds are there. If Hallen Reed is there and he's with Jojen and Mira, that makes sense. You get two strong reasons to go visit that's when their fathers met. You know what I mean? So that's, you know, did a great deed, and since then they've kept some secret. It is important. So it seems like Bran would be interested in that, and during his training he might venture down that route. So, and he's been coming across John as well, and there's been some interesting connections between Weirwood and Wolf Dream and things like that. So
yeah,
I kind of think it is going to happen.
Yeah, I think we'll get it, but I don't think it's going to be like, I don't know if it's going to be the more I've thought about it recently, because I think it's going to be told to us through somebody else, like the full events of what happened there. So I think I definitely think we're getting the information of what went down there. But I think it could be from a Hallen Reed emerging, or a like John Connington explaining it, you know, in the show. It's kind of a few people figure it out. You know, Bran figures it out by seeing the events. And then Sam Sam figures out that Rhaegar and Lyanna were in love and were married. And then he talks to Bran and they kind of figure it all out together, figure the whole thing out all together. So, I mean, the show is kind of two sets of people figure it out. So it's possible that it'll be more in the books, and the timing of it, I think, will be important too. I think the timing of the reveal of information and everything will be way different in the books, because there's just a lot more players with young Griff, and who knows if it's going to be the same as the show with them, like figuring it out all right before the Night King marches. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, one more thing, you know, that I want to kind of bring up here that Eric, hinted at real quickly. The idea that R plus L equals J, like if that's true, I know a lot of people will sometimes default to, well, then we have to have a prince that was promised, and we have to have a Azor Ahai in the prophecy fulfilled. I think what George does is say these two people believed in that prophecy, and because they believed in it, that caused them to do the things that they did, or Rhaegar and other people to do the things that they did, even with their powers, because they believed in some ancient, long ago prophecy that. I think it's almost a commentary on some of our society and our belief systems here that, you know, why do we act and do things the way that we do? It's because of our belief system, because we believe we're going to one place or another place or whatever it might be. And that might guide some of our decision making. So his characters in his story are guided by gods and religion and prophecy, and they have maybe even powers, and maybe there is blood magic, and there's things like that. But really, it doesn't mean that it's going to happen that way, you know? So I don't know. I feel like there could have been other people who were trying to fulfill the prophecy. Like, we may even see that during the Blackfyre Rebellion, or go back even further. Is there some time before Aegon's conquest, and going back to the Age of Legends or whatever, Age of Legends, Age of Heroes, you know?
Same thing.
Wheel of Time, same thing. Is there in that thousands of years, did other people try to fulfill the prophecy? Were they not believers of Azor Ahai or the prince that was promised? And again, some of that stuff is more recent. Even you go look at Valyria and when did some of these things kind of come over to Westeros? But like, people start to believe in that stuff, and then I want to fulfill that, and then they do things that will set them on a path that take us to Robert's Rebellion, that take us to things like, you know, this the wall coming down and stuff. But you know, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting. So I just wanted to bring that up real quickly. Doesn't, you know, necessarily, although I'm cool with it. I love a great fantasy tale. And if you're going to tell me that Azor Ahai is going to step out here and save everybody, let's go. You know, I'm all for it.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, that is mostly it for us today. Just a quick reminder, guys, if you do want to follow Azor Ahai on social media, you can do so at Instagram, Twitter, womprat underscore 2M for Ez, at Super Gains Bros for myself. We have some more. We've been producing some more YouTube exclusive content. I did a big video that I was talking about there, asking a lot of those questions. So certainly check that out as well. For those of you who have not subscribed, really appreciate it. For everyone who has, Patreon Zoom Hangout will be gearing up for another one of those here soon. I'm kind of thinking maybe the end of the month when I'm on vacation in Mexico. So, because we've been, you know, we've been fortunate enough to have people from all over the world. So let's just add another country on that list at the time.
Yeah.
So it's like we had people from Germany and the United Kingdom and Australia and Canada. And, okay, we'll have, you know, just
Ireland. Another, don't forget
Ireland. Yeah. Right, the whole deal. I said the United Kingdom. That's a joke for people who've been who have been on the Zoom hangout. So all right, guys. Well, with that, we want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, this is what happens when I don't pull it up.
I know it's a Bran chapter. It's I think it's 46 Bran, but I don't know which one.
Oh, it's probably, well, it's Bran. Chapter 46 Bran.
There we go. Yes. If you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com.
We will see you in a week, and remember that winter is coming.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.